Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 65 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the science writer and poet Peter Forbes talks us through a career that has always relied on the power, precision and adaptability of words. And then the playwright and screenwriter Stephen Wakelam explains how to survive changing fashions in TV drama while at heart staying the same. First up, here's Peter Forbes with Occupational Tics and Professional Diseases.
Throughout my writing life, the short piece, typically 900 words, has been my staple, whether columns, articles or reviews. I did eventually make the transition to writing full-length books, but it was a tortuous process. My first published prose was a column in the forum section of New Scientist in 1980, entitled Occupational Tics and Professional Diseases, in which I tried to establish the notion of a blind spot in scientific practice that I named a scientist's squint. Reading it now reminds me which of my notions about writing have changed and which have stayed with me. The article was a loosely coupled ramble, frantically packed with literary references. Anxious to be a real writer, I thought I had to write at the top of my voice to be heard. Every sentence needed a striking phrase. Names must be dropped. I favoured an ornate, convoluted style, being in love with Auden's prose section, Caliban to the Audience, In the Sea and the Mirror, which is a pastiche of Henry James's extremely mannered prose. I thought that science being so rich in material, imagery and structure, a plain style would never do. A science book called Mortal Lessons by Richard Seltzer, a surgeon, greatly appealed to me, even though it had received bad reviews for its almost pornographically relished bodily detail. Over the next 5 years or so, I wrote dozens of such columns for New Scientist, World Medicine, Vole and New Statesman. The change of outlook was often dictated by an editor leaving. I hopped around, trying to find the perfect outlet for my think pieces, as I like to call them. None of them passes muster any longer. Looking back, I realised that I was too quick to form an opinion and too slow to absorb the full particulars of the case. I still write 900-word articles, but now they have mostly morphed into reviews. Parquet Orwell's Confessions of a Book Reviewer, what's not to like about reviewing? Instead of having to define all the parameters of what you want to write about, here is the found subject, a book on a topic in which you're deeply interested. It's part of your research, your education, and you get paid for it. You can triangulate the subject, the author's take on it, and your own. Of course, reviewing can be hack work, Orwell's constantly inventing reactions towards books about which one has no spontaneous feelings whatever. These days it is notoriously poorly paid. But as a reader, I have always read the book's pages avidly. I'll go so far to say that as a schoolboy, reading Cyril Connolly's reviews in the Sunday Times awoke me to the possibility of the literary life. So, although I can't be a Cyril Connolly, to be a regular reviewer is a wheel come satisfyingly full circle. Oscar Wilde wrote in The Critic as Artist that criticism was a higher art, and that one day the elect would shun trying to turn life into art and busy themselves entirely with criticism. Without going so far, writing about a book whose subject is greatly interesting is a very special pleasure. I've written hundreds of reviews since then, and the pleasure never palls. What has lasted from my earlier columnist days is my love of phrase-making. What will remain of us is love, wrote Philip Larkin, but what remains of him, in the currency of our life now, are his unforgettable phrases, which pop into my mind on appropriate occasions. He had a genius for bringing a few commonplace words into proximity to create a minor miracle of encapsulation. That much-mentioned brilliance, love, success so huge and wholly farcical, this frowsty accoutred balm. Whatever I've been writing about, I've always aimed to make it a piece of writing and not just a sure-hugging paraphrase of reality. The effects a larkin can contrive are all the more valuable for their hurts and rareness, to misappropriate a phrase from a much underrated poet, John Fuller. Actually, like Larkin, he was writing about love again. Some phrases are so irresistible, we want to use them even when not strictly appropriate. I've always had this feeling that, compared to music and painting, which I love as much as writing, we're constrained by the fact that, in order to make sense, our scope for originality at the sentence level is limited. To my writing class, I read the passage from Molière's Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, in which he's pointed out to Monsieur Jourdan not only that he's been speaking prose all his life, but that if he wants to say, "Fair Marquise, your lovely eyes make me die of love," no tinkering by a professional writer can improve on it. But against this, it is possible, in three or four words, to coin something that is unforgettable and will soon be on everyone's lips. It isn't only literary writers who can do this. A cricketer once called a batsman a flat-track bully. I would love to have written that. It was coined by the New Zealand cricketer John Bracewell in 1989 to describe the English batsman Graham Hick, who scored a prodigious number of runs in county cricket, but who consistently failed at test level. The phrase has endured, has been applied in contexts way beyond cricket, and has entered the lexicon. Hardly a week going by, but it is printed somewhere. I don't even remember now where I found that phrase, occupational tics and professional diseases. I think it was a modulation from the French, la déformation professionnelle. My preference for ornate Mandarin prose took a knock in 1986 when I read Primo Levi's The Periodic Table. Levi was a chemist like me. Beyond that, our lives could not have been more different. But Levi's writing taught me that a writer possessing knowledge of the wonders and terrors of the universe and of the extremes of the human condition did not have to strain to find a style to fit the material. Levi was a man of great wisdom, who weighed his words like a chemist weighing his reagents. His phrase-making was just, accurate and unstrained. This is from the periodic table. Distilling is beautiful. First of all, because it is a slow, philosophic and silent occupation, which keeps you busy but gives you time to think of other things, somewhat like riding a bike. Then, because it involves a metamorphosis from liquid to vapour, invisible, and from this once again to liquid. But in this double journey, up and down, purity is attained, an ambiguous and fascinating condition. And finally, when you set about distilling, you acquire the consciousness of repeating a ritual consecrated by the centuries. A calm gaze that lets things find their verbal equivalent without strain or overreaching now seems to me the ideal. But in reading Primo Levi in 1986, I was still a long way from writing books of my own. That year I became editor of Poetry Review, a job that lasted for 16 years. The demands of editing that kind of small magazine were not compatible with writing books, and it was this that tipped me towards reviewing. But being a poetry editor has special delights as well. I've always been suspicious of people who need their literary canon predigested. It is easy to drool over artists whose excellence has been attested by many critics over the generations. A poetry editor faces a postbag of totally unmediated work, which ranges from the subliterate to tomorrow's genius. It is well known that when famous authors have put the reviewing system to the test by releasing books under a nom de plume, the system has often failed. No one's judgment is infallible, because literary appreciation is not a science, but that postbag did teach me that it is possible to spot nascent talent. But by the mid-90s, I was seriously beginning to wrestle with the idea of the book. Much as I loved writing short pieces, their ephemerality troubled me. If I was a writer, shouldn't I have something more solid to show for it? I was much exercised at the time by the wave of postmodernist and post-structuralist theory, which had spilled over from English studies and philosophy and was snapping at the heels of science. Relativism questioned the whole edifice of the science of the last 350 years. To me, this was a kind of hysteria that needed puncturing, and I began assembling a magnum opus on science and art to achieve just that. The manuscript did receive some interest, but was not in the end accepted, and I came to realise that I tried to pour a whole series of volumes into one book, just like those overloaded phrases packed into my first published article. The postmodernist tide receded, and I came to see that some of the chapters of this magnum opus, each fleshed out to book length, could have a life of their own. The chapter I selected as my first book was originally called The Natural Engineer, but my editor soon tipped me towards the better-selling title The Gecko's Foot, which was published in 2005. Its subject was the then new, but now burgeoning science of bioinspiration, technical materials and processes derived from nature, such as a powerful dry adhesive derived from the gecko's foot, self-cleaning surfaces from the lotus leaf, dazzling optical effects based on butterfly wing scales, and so on. The Gecko's Foot is my most satisfying achievement as a writer. It was a pioneering book on its subject and is still in print almost 10 years later. Occasionally I get messages suggesting that the book has reach, the best of which came from a researcher at Cambridge whom I contacted about a topic for my most recent book, Nanoscience, Giants of the Infinitesimal, co-written with a sculptor, Tom Grimsey, who told me that The Gecko's Foot, read when he was a student in South Africa and unsure of his direction, had helped decide his career. A book makes its way mostly unseen, but hints like this are what make it worthwhile. A lifetime isn't enough to learn about writing. I had the pleasant shock only a few years ago of reading Guy Deutsch's The Unfolding of Language, which revealed answers to some of language's greatest mysteries. Early on, it was the Baroque superstructure of writing that interested me. But Deutsch taught me that more interesting than the multitudinous seas in Carnadine is how the word of was invented. Deutsch is a palate cleanser. I have always been acutely aware that, as language users, most of the work has been done before us by those who elaborated the vast skein of meanings, syntactical constructions and metaphors. But I was still taken aback when I read The Unfolding of Language. Deutsch not only shows how language has evolved and how metaphor is the tool by which we created abstract words, he is even plausibly able to divine how words like in, of, up, from, perhaps, however, nevertheless, albeit, and so on, came into the world. To begin with metaphor, what could be more stale, more leadenly cliché-ridden than this? At the cabinet meeting, groundbreaking plans were put forward to curb the power of the unions. This is now a reef of dead metaphors, but all dead metaphors were once alive. Cabinet, groundbreaking, curb. Cabinet and groundbreaking obviously derived from the physical world, but what is a curb? Curb is part of a horse's bridle, but the word is almost only used now in the abstract sense. Kitchen images have produced countless metaphors. Troubles brew, anger boils over, discontent ferments. It goes further. All abstract words had to have a concrete thing or action behind them. So decide means to cut off. Sarcastic means flesh-tearing. Compare sarcophagus. Redundant means overflowing, from under, a wave. So if all our abstract and functional words derive originally from physical parts of the body, the physical environment, food and its preparation and so on, where do verbs come from? Verbs were originally nouns, a process still going on at some pace. We head the ball, hand it to them, leaf through a book, iron a shirt. But prepositions? Prepositions come mostly from parts of the body or verbs. So the front, in front of, was originally the forehead, as in Shakespeare's grim-visaged war has smoothed his wrinkled front. In some languages, for can be seen to be derived from give, the act of giving something meaning that it is for someone. With has developed from the concept of following. The process can be seen at work in a Groucho Marx joke, which collapses the expansive nature of metaphoric language back into the literal again. Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. So the principle of exclusion was first expressed by the concept of physical exclusion. Outside and inside were originally just parts of the body. The joke relies on the old literal meaning of outside colliding with the newer meaning of abstract exclusion. The other great revelation of Deutsch's book is that although languages always seem to be decaying, they never actually die. In fact, they gain in expressiveness and accuracy. It is now known that the process of erosion is also the process of creation. Language, in this sense, resembles geology. Deutsch gives, as an example, the history of the French for today. The Latin hoc die became hodie, and then hui in early French. The word was tending to disappear. Very common in French, for example, the consonantless O derived from aqua. So, au jour d'hui, on the day that is today, was introduced to bolster the word's physicality. This then decayed to aujourd'hui in modern French. According to Deutsch, au jour d'aujourd'hui is a developing idiom. So, as a word decays, it is rescued from oblivion by adding to it. In effect, in the latest manifestation, people are saying, the day that is the day that is today. Whether au jour d'aujourd'hui will catch on, we don't yet know. After reading Deutsch, you weigh your words even more carefully. The recipes of Orwell, good prose is like a window pane, Eliot, the word neither diffident nor ostentatious, an easy commerce of the old and the new, and Levy, you will say of each word you have used why you have used that one and not another. All of these have an extra bite.
That was Peter Forbes, recorded by Carol Angier. You can find out more about Peter on his website at www.pforbes.org. Next, here's Stephen Wakelam with Altering My Swing.
I remember a particular evening in White City, at the old BBC TV headquarters in the late 80s. I'd been asked to address a group of BBC employees, accountants, secretaries, makeup and costume people, car park attendants, anyone interested in short, who wanted to be writers. In the course of the talk, I showed them extracts from three films I'd made for the BBC over a period of about 7 years. Completely separate, I thought. The first was Gaskin, a drama documentary starring the young Paul McGann, about a Liverpool teenager who sued the city council for their lack of care during his childhood. The second film was called Coppers. It starred Tim Roth, a fiction based on a real case about two South London lads who dressed up as policemen. And the third was Angel Voices, semi-autobiographical film about a parish church choir who go to sing and get into trouble at Blackpool in the 60s. Michael Williams played their choirmaster. I don't know what my group of BBC employees made of the evening, but I had a revelation. I'd been writing the same film for most of the 80s, or at least the same theme underlay each of them. All were about someone who was half in, half out of a group or society, looking in. I tapped into something in myself, urgent and barely understood, and was now looking at my own unconscious literary personality. You put on the characteristics of somebody else while writing, but can't help but reveal yourself. It probably explains your choice of subjects, why you choose one subject rather than another. The decade after this talk, the 90s, were a tricky time for me as a writer. The single play or film, my preferred form, as a staple of weekly television was over in an era of multi-channels. The terms of trade had turned against me. We were into ratings. Producers' jobs were on the line. Managers were taking over. Television drama had become very much top-down. What the head of drama wants is, or chillingly, we're looking for shows that make a louder noise. I found myself writing what other people wanted me to write, rather than what I wanted to write. It was almost certainly time to do something else. knuckle down to real life. Instead, I went a long wander. I sold my flat, spent a lot of time living cheaply in France. I thought I was finished as a writer, or the writer I wanted to be. I did a certain amount of tutoring at the National Theatre, with some brilliant and then barely known young writers, one-to-one, the more experienced writer, me, helping bring on these upstarts. I did a good job by them, I hope, and also envied them. They were fresh and had experiences that they needed to write about. My own experiences just weren't working for me anymore. I was paid by the BBC at one point to go over to Brussels, sniff out the commission. I covered the Guinness trial again for the BBC, a major city scandal at the time, and came up short. I now realise what was the problem. I'm not really a political animal. I don't have strong views. My natural tone of voice is ironic, even light-hearted, certainly not earnest, and that I'm probably a miniaturist. What I attempt to do with a play is offer the maximum insight with minimum number of words. The big plays I was trying to write in the 90s, as opposed to the quirkier pieces of the 80s, weren't me, didn't play to my strengths. I was going against the grain, I was straining. I've always admired Nick Faldo, the golfer. Not as a man, too self-obsessed, but the fact that as a young and successful golfer, he realised that his technique, or swing, wasn't secure enough to see him through, so took a couple of years out to alter and perfect a new swing, and then came back to win half a dozen majors. What I was doing or letting happen on my wander in the late 90s was altering my swing, ripening in idleness, as Balzac put it. I knew this wouldn't take a matter of months, but maybe years, if I could survive. I was reading a lot of autobiography, still am, not novels. I'd grown tired through spending my days making up my own fictions, of other people's fictions, fantasies, and it was through my reading and the time and space I gave myself that I found my voice again, recovered confidence, and entered a new phase as a playwright. It was the year 2000. I started no longer writing mainly from my own direct experience. I can make things up. It was how I'd made a living after all. But I can't imagine any more sitting down with a blank screen and fictionalising. From early on as a writer without being aware of it, I was always more comfortable with facts. My first play had been a slice of my mother's life. My second play, about a failed professional footballer, had been the experience of a good friend of mine. What I started writing were biographical plays. In time, Tolstoy, Shakespeare, Flaubert no less. I suppose more strictly you'd call them a fictional recasting of actual events. This involves plenty of research, which I enjoy. And it's arguable that these days I can't write without having what we might call data to start with. The only fiction is the gaps between the dots of data. So I still make things up, but try hard to keep to what we know happened. Annie Prue of The Shipping News and Brokeback Mountain questions the usual advice I've given it in my time myself to young writers: write about what you know. She says, learn what you want to write about, find out about it. That's me, now. To give an example, in a play which didn't give up its secrets until almost too late, in other words, was a great deal more than simply a biographical account, I wrote a play for Radio 3 about Montaigne, the French essayist whom I noticed in his later life embarked on a diplomatic mission, negotiating between princes to help bring to an end the wars of religion in France. I was pleased to have discovered this mission, the swan song of his life. It's generally been ignored in favour of the Montaigne we know, the sage who wrote his essays in a tower. There was plenty of drama, of course, in that trip he undertook. He was arrested, hijacked, fell ill, probably witnessed an assassination. But I'd given him a young secretary. I called him Pellier. Montaigne had secretaries, though we know nothing about them. So I made up a young man, the illegitimate son of a priest, I thought, and a bit provincial, though bright. What I hadn't foreseen was how this made-up character would take over the show, despite all the obvious derring-do of the piece. Quite late on in the writing, I realised that what the play was truly about was the relationship between the old master and his amanuensis, that I was heading for the moment when one generation passes the baton over. That was the resonance of the play for me. Henry IV, Navarre, the new king, a Protestant, wanted Montaigne, a Catholic, to be his adviser. In real life, Montaigne turned him down, citing ill health. In my fiction, I had him sending young Pellier in his stead. The climactic scene became Montaigne instructing Pellier on how best to negotiate with princes. The title of the play was Living with Princes, handing on his expertise. Pellier walked into the first scene. He hadn't featured in the synopsis or selling document and almost took the play over. Incidentally, I called him Pellier after the great French jockey. There were two other minor fictional characters necessarily introduced to keep the wheels turning, and Pellier was joined by a Sergeant Soumillon and a Captain Guillaume, both also the names of French jockeys. No one noticed. Someone said of Shakespeare that borrowing from literary models, he made up only a couple of plots, helped him escape from the vices of singularity and useless invention. I suppose I do the same as the great man, only my stories are taken from a slice of biography, a few months or years, no more. I take the facts for granted. Montaigne's married, has a daughter, suffers from kidney stones. He's a Catholic, and Navarre, a Protestant, trusts him. And there's the play I wrote about Shakespeare, which follows the facts as we know them scrupulously, the script of which is on my website, stephenwakelam.net. It's called The Pattern of Painful Adventures. This started as a play about John Marston, Shakespeare's younger playwright contemporary, who gave up the stage for 25 years of obscurity as a parish priest. Marston makes, I hope, a memorable appearance in the play, but which moved in the writing away from him. I lived at the time just round the corner from a pub in Clerkenwell, run in the early 17th century by a man called George Wilkins, who probably collaborated with Shakespeare on that late play called Pericles. The pub was a bawdy house in Wilkins' day, and that interested me about Shakespeare's collaborator and about the senior playwright. Though Wilkins and Marston stay prominent in the piece, the play shifted under my fingers to become very much about the tricky relationship between Shakespeare and his younger brother and eldest daughter, who were of an age, one a Stratford girl who's just married sensibly and well, the other a licentious young actor. I think what the play's really about is the clash between a rakish London life and a more staid and respectable provincial existence. In my play, Shakespeare's very uncomfortably torn between the two. I can't plead innocency of life, he says. And my old friend Hanif Qureshi used to say of me, I was an interesting and conflicted mix of provincial and metropolitan. I like it when a play wanders where it will, to use a Shakespearean-sounding phrase, before finding itself. I like to write a bit out of control, but within factual parameters, reining in a bit when needed. But there's a considerable degree of freedom in this latest phase of my writing career. Biographical writing, particularly when the facts are scarce, is a cheerfully impure art, one in which I suggest the biographer reveals perhaps as much of himself and his preoccupations as of his subject. In short, try as you might, You can't, as a better writer than me once said. Keep the author out.
That was Stephen Wakelam, recorded by Francis Burns. You can find out more about Stephen on his website at www.stephenwakelam.org. That's Stephen with a PH and Wakelam ending in AM. And that concludes episode 65, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 66, the novelist Fiona Shaw tells Frances Burns of how she felt an affinity with her PhD subject, the poet Elizabeth Bishop, but never anticipated being a writer herself until severe emotions forced something out of her. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.